Well, I want to thank Shariki and the American Institute for Cancer Research for the invitation to speak to you today. I'm going to be a little bit different than what Shariki said in that I'm not going to focus too much on the data specifically because I think you all know what the data is. It hasn't changed in two decades. And so for me to go through that again would be just to rehash what we already know over the past 20 years. As Tip O'Neill once said, all politics are local, and I say all health is local. And with that, all data should be local. And you are here in my presentation, which I'll try to give you as quick as possible in this short period of time, because as I told Shariki, I have yet to learn how to clone myself, and I'm scheduled to give another presentation tonight in College Station. So I have to make a flight or else I won't be there and there'll be an empty suit standing at the podium. Einstein once said, insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over again and expecting the same outcome. We're constantly looking for the healthiest individual when we do clinical trials. The healthiest individual with one disease, so that our statisticians can calculate what the effect of that drug is. To me, that's an oxymoron. And to some extent, that's why we still are where we are when we look at stage 3 and 4 disease, because those diseases generally occur in a manner in which there are other confounding factors. The same thing, I think, occurs now when we talk about healthy people. We've gone through healthy people 2000, we've gone through healthy people 2010, and now we're at healthy people 2020. I thought we had learned something when the first report or the first gathering of healthy people, when we called it Healthy People USA, at least it didn't give people a pretense that we would have something done by 2020, and maybe it would have taken the pressure off of doing something by 2020, and maybe we would have accomplished something. Miles Maberly once said, if you always do what you've already done, you always get what you already got. And unfortunately, when we approach efforts to deal with the lack of real progress in addressing health disparities, we tend to fall back to what we've done before. It may be in a different name or packaged in a different box, but ultimately, it is the same strategy. I like to give solutions to the problems up front because generally, when I give these talks, by the time I get to the end, most people have either left or done something else. So let me give you at least my 5 ways of looking at this and then spend the rest of the time I have remaining trying to explain each of them, or at least 2 of them. You know, there are 5 elements originally written for establishing an effective cancer education program, but I think these 5 elements are very much in play when we talk about health disparities and addressing inequalities in terms of cancer. The first states that a committee which plans to provide the program should include persons who represent the populations targeted to be served. Generally, when we get these committees together, they're generally our friends, our colleagues, and generally not the people who we're targeting. Secondly, major items should refer to a local cancer and health plan. If one does not exist, one should be developed while proceeding. And most of my talk will be on this particular area. Use of a wide range of health education communications methods to capitalize on the strength of these. This should be done with the community. And I often say Ebonics is a language. If you talk to linguists, it is a language in terms of originally from Africa. And so if we put down people in terms of their dialects and how they express themselves, to some extent, how are we going to get their trust? The need for a procedure and our instrument to measure success at the beginning, at the middle, and at the end. And then lastly, there's a need for sufficient funds and manpower to carry out this plan. If you don't have it, don't start. This one I violate, and therefore I won't talk about it. The idea of data. As I said, I could talk about each of the 5, but what I want to do is talk about data. Where does it come from, and how do we use it? We've all seen something like this in terms of looking at the incidence and mortality rate from cancer. And generally, these This data comes from large data sets, but let me show you why this may be misleading to some extent, and to some extent why the Journal of the American Medical Association published about 2 years ago that we had not made any progress in terms of health disparities despite all the money and all the efforts in terms of reducing the gap. I don't know how many of you have seen this slide. This is Black America and this is Hispanic America. And Texas is the battleground right in the middle, as you may see where it overlaps. This is a 2008, now 2010 census report, now including the whole idea of multi-ethnic population. But if you go back to this slide, we still characterize people basically in terms of Black and white. And although the census includes multi-ethnic groups, it's still collapsed in terms of cancer or cancer statistics into the five populations. But when we do data and talk about incidence, it is the surveillance, epidemiology, and end result are what we fondly refer to as SEER. I've been around long enough to know when SEER started and what its original purpose was. Its original purpose was not policy. Its original purpose was to do research, and research at those specific institutions. It was not set up as a national database to look at cancer incidence and mortality rates. And yet, we still use it in that manner, and I think that's part of our problem. I should mention that the one in yellow down here, Louisiana, is still recouping from Katrina, and it's probably not completely online. But let me show you how we go astray. My area of research, at least one of them, looks at breast cancer. And this hasn't changed too much. 89% of the incidence data that we get from SEER comes from these four cities in terms of breast cancer. And if you look at this compared to where we get the data, we're roughly somewhere between 58 to 60%, depending on what numbers you look at, where most of African Americans live. And there really is not a SEER register in Texas. And if you look at only within the last 2 years, 2 to 3 years, have we become part of the gold standard that's used by the CDC in terms of statistical registries with regards to incidence in terms of cancer. 3 years ago, I used to say, well, I guess there weren't Blacks in Texas, and therefore, you know, we didn't get cancer, and therefore it wasn't used in the registry. It's now still used, or used now. But the best registry that I've come across is the one in Kentucky. And the one in Kentucky really tells why local data is important to be used. Here's the rates, and I haven't been able to get the new ones, but they're basically the same. If one looked at the SEER registry and looked at lung cancer and invasive cervical cancer, and then looked at the white population in Kentucky based on SEER data, you would say, well, there's not a problem there, and Blacks have most of the problem. But if you go back, let's see if I can get it there, and it's these counties right here in this area. If you take these counties within this area and look at the data with regards to cervical cancer and lung cancer, you'll see that their problems are just as bad as it is in terms of the Black cancer, or Black Kentuckians, as well as cervical cancer. And if you used national data statistics, if you use SEER, you would overlook this. And you would say those people don't have a problem. But they do have a problem. In Houston, about 3 years ago, I was asked to become part of the Avon Breast Cancer Task Force because they had began to look at data in several major metropolitan cities, Houston being one, New York City being another, Chicago being another, and LA being another. And the data that they were able to find and actually publish on was really shocking. And the most shocking thing was that Blacks in Houston are 45% more likely to die from breast cancer than white women. And in fact, if we compared the data in terms of white women in New York City, it was four times the rate in terms of death. The racial disparities gap in breast cancer mortality rates in Houston is higher than the national average and even worse. If we just relied on SEER or forgot to turn my phone off. Sorry. But the recent data suggests that African-American women in Houston are now equally likely to get breast cancer as Caucasians, which is highly unusual in the United States. Again, if we didn't have this fact or have this data, we wouldn't be thinking about this problem. But I want to point this out. The newspapers got the story half right. What they failed to realize was that the mortality rate for white Americans, The newspaper got the story half right. What they failed to realize was that the incidence in terms of breast cancer for white Americans in Houston is also twofold greater in terms of mortality rate than New York City. What's going on in terms of the city, in terms of Houston? That's the question I ask. And if you look at this in terms of incidence and mortality rate, and the reason why I put this up is that we're constantly being told that the incidence of breast cancer in African American women in the United States is lower than white females, that the mortality rate is higher both in young African Americans and older African Americans. But in Houston, that's not the case. And it's getting worse as we track this. What's going on? I'll also mention with regards to a study that was recently done by one of my postdocs who's now at Penn State, because it gave us the idea, if this is going on in terms of African Americans, is something going on with Hispanic Americans as well in the city of Houston? And what we were able to show in the Mexican American cohort study, which is being run by Melissa Bondi, is that the incidence cases that we've been able to track within that cohort, half of the women who develop breast cancer are under the age of 50. So if the policies that were put in place or were asked to be put in place by the U.S. United States Public Preventive Task Force, we would have a problem in Texas. We would have a major problem in Houston. Because all these women that we picked up early by screening them under the age of 50 would not be screened. And in fact, we've now gone back to the Harris County Hospital District data, and the same thing is occurring. But here's Chicago. And that's why I asked about white Americans, because here's the incidence rate or the mortality rate in terms of Chicago, 19, which is almost 80% lower, 70 to 80% lower in Chicago than it is in Houston. What is Chicago doing that Houston is not doing? And as you notice, the incidence or the mortality rate for African Americans is almost the same in Chicago. Something's going on. And when I point this out to individuals, I say between here and here, this is not a biological change. Something else is going on here that we need to find out about. But this is not to discount the issue of genetics going on in terms of breast cancer in African American women, and the issue that we need to look at it differently than we've looked at it before. For instance, this is an area in Africa, in West Africa, that has one of the highest incidences of premenopausal breast cancer. It was the same in terms of historical records that we've been able to find during slavery. It's the same today. It hasn't changed in over 200 years. And so this population actually were brought into the Chesapeake Bay Area. And this is one of the areas in the United States that has one of the highest incidences of breast cancer, including both pre- and postmenopausal breast cancer. But it's also in blacks and whites. And that gets to the issue of how do we find blacks and whites. Because 30% of the individuals that came out of this area, or at least 30% of the white females that actually came from, that were Scotch-Irish, that actually settled in this area, married African slaves. Some of them are now defined as being white Americans. I have a good colleague who I said, you know, if you were born in New Orleans, you would be black. Because the Ames test says that 16% of your alleles are African. But you just happen to be born in Maryland. And a lot of your colleagues were born in Maryland, and therefore, it's how they define who's white. And this is just to give you the data that we've been able to come up with in terms of about 40% of the women actually under the age of 40, between ages of 20 and 40, that have developed breast cancer in that region. But this gets to the question, which one of these individuals is a good candidate for Bidil? Any of you know what Bidil is? Bidil is a drug that had been recently approved by the FDA only for African Americans. simply because they said it had a higher impact on African Americans. Well, then who is an African American? Is it this individual, or this individual? In fact, it's all of them. Because the idea is that to define African Americans as a race means that God laid hands on the Nile Passage and made everybody alike. Because Africa is one of the most diverse continents, genetically diverse continents in the world. And here's this young lady, which most of you thought were Asian. Her father is African American. She just happened to pick up most of the features from her mom. And I like to put this one up. We consider this guy African American, but he is not genetically related to this guy. Nor is he genetically related to this guy, nor is he genetically related to this guy. He's genetically related to him, and probably him. The reason? His lineage is from East Africa. His lineage is from West Africa. The genetic pool in East Africa is different than the genetic pool in West Africa. But yet, both of them are classified as African Americans. And if you look at them in terms of biological studies, they would both be put in the same pool. And we often wonder why one group says, in terms of cancer statistics and responses, African Americans do this, and then you get another report that says African Americans do that. The only way that we're going to address this, and I hope that in terms of the next talks that you will hear, is to think about, we're going to have to look at more than the cancer biology. We're going to have to look at more of the epidemiology. We're going to have to look at more of the social sciences, our genetics and anthropology. We're going to have to look at all of these things together. We're going to have to look at this in terms of a biopsychosocial approach, and that is a research vision that is inclusive and has a contextual framework that integrates molecular and cell biology, behavioral sciences, as well as social sciences. It basically acknowledges all possible influences that might affect the quality of life, both positive and negative. It is the understanding that health cannot be addressed as a single issue, that it has to take into account other factors that influence the perceived need for health care and attention to health concerns, housing, education, economics, comorbidities, other existing diseases and illnesses, adequate access or even lack of access to health care, as well as a multitude of other things. We have to look at health outcomes as being the central feature of this. In the talk I gave yesterday, I said, we've forgotten the word public in public health. Most of the schools of public health have forgotten the word public in public health. We need to bring that back into the holistic idea of looking at this. And with health outcomes, not the number of papers, not the number of grants that we get, but a changing in terms of the health outcomes of society. And I close with this. This is why I'm here, and this is why I'm still continuing to beat this drum. These are my grandsons. This is my daughter, who I'll probably have to still continue to work because she's decided to be a pediatrician to the poor. And with that, I asked you to do one brave thing today, and then run like hell. Thank you. You want to take one question?
Yeah, why don't you take one, and you can stay to the end of the session, right?
No, I have to.
You have to leave, like, literally right now. Okay, why don't you take one or two
questions? Okay. I run like hell. Okay. Ah. I think it's gene environment interaction, but I think it's what we began to do is trace the lineage of the Africans who settled into that area. And a lot of them, actually a good percentage of them, come from that area. What I didn't show you was the ports of entry of Africans into the United States. And there's a subset of those individuals who actually come into the Mississippi Delta. We're working with Fatima Jackson and Rick Kills to really start to look at lineages in terms of the populations within that area, including the white population.
There's an aspect in your comments that are depressing because it's all data is local. It suggests all research is local. summarize from broader studies and evidence to what I should be doing with my local populations. Could you comment on that?
That's exactly true. I think large data sets are good, you know, and I get booed sometimes. But large data sets are good for graduate students to publish and postdocs to get new jobs. To some extent, and I'm only talking about cancer now, diabetes, I don't know, because cancer is 100 diseases. And it varies depending on the gene-environment interaction where you are. And so, you know, for instance, I can show you data on prostate cancer, where African-American women have the lowest incidence of prostate cancer in Arizona. Doesn't mean that just because they moved to Arizona, they're going to have a lower incidence. It may be the populations that move there, because there are certain groups in Africa that have extremely low incidence of prostate cancer. Not all African lineage has high incidence of prostate cancer. And so we need to rethink how we approach this, because we approach this as if African Americans all come out of the same cookie cutter. We also approach it as if European Americans all came out of the same cookie cutter. And to some extent, maybe in terms of Europe, but when you get to the U.S. in terms of the ag mixture that has taken place here, in terms of the different populations that have given rise to the populations here, we have to rethink that. And there's a slide that I often show, too, that calls causations in terms of health disparities. And one of the causations that I list all the time is using data from Switzerland, China, Japan, and Canada. Because they don't represent the ag mixture of this country. They don't represent the ag mixture plus the environment of this country. Nor do they represent the political environment that we live in. The study out of China in terms of Shanghai occurred in Tiananmen Square. Think about that in terms of how people respond to screening surveys. Yet we use that data to say that we shouldn't do self-breast exams. You know, that, to me, that's an oxymoron. It makes for a good publication, but think about it.
Yeah.
You've made a good case for genetic, for looking at the genetic lines that lead to certain cancers. Are there protocols for looking at lineage data collection that we might be able to link to, as you're suggesting here, West African origin, and many people don't know where they come from. Anyway,
right.
But if there were protocols, is there a protocol?
Yeah, there are protocols. The problem is that we end up in three camps. We end up in the access issue camp that sit and talk about access. We end up in the biological camp that says it's genes and that's what we're going to look at. And then we end up in the social determinist camp and say it's all social determinants. It's all of those. And that, you know, what my clarion call is, we all need to sit at the table in terms of addressing this, because it may be one more than the other, depending on the location and where we are and the populations that are there. It's not one single thing. Thank you.
Thank you.